All right. Oh, welcome back for part two of our two-part episode. Man, I'm always excited when we could kind of come back here and dive a little bit deeper, and my guest gets to ask me even more questions here. So for those who missed last week, please go to rosskrause.com, rosskrause.com, to listen to part one of our episode. It'll be about 25 minutes, and then you'll be up to date. But without further ado, let's get into part two of our two-part episode today. I'm very excited for what we have to go over.
Welcome back, everyone, to an episode of The Money Seat, the show where my guests put me, the host, on the hot seat. They ask me five questions related to finance and money. They have not sent me these questions beforehand, so I'm hearing them for the first time as you are. And I also don't edit it out, so I can't really make myself sound smarter than I really am with some strategic editing. So hoping this makes for some interesting conversations. And without any more delay, I'm excited to bring in my next guest here, Adam. And why don't you tell the audience a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Thanks, Ross. So I'm 32 years old. I currently work in finance, but more corporate finance, so less investments, more, you know, just making money for a business. I work in healthcare right now. So that's a little bit about my work, but on a more personal note, I was recently married.
All right.
And I live in Deerfield, Illinois with my now wife and our French bulldog named Albert and our two cats, Daisy, the girl, and Gray, the little boy.
I'm assuming since you introduced your dog and your two cats that you don't have kids, right?
No, Albert and the cats are our only animal children.
Okay, that's good. I'm sure they keep you plenty busy.
Oh yeah.
So what school did you go to? I'm assuming if you're in finance, you probably have undergrad and possibly a graduate degree.
Yeah, so I went to undergrad at Wisconsin-Madison. I got a degree in finance and economics from there.
Right.
And I worked in corporate finance in retail for a few years. And then I went back to school and got my MBA from University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana.
Okay. And did you get that done recently?
Yeah, that was about three years ago. So I've been working for a little bit over 3 years since graduating.
Have you found that the MBA has kind of helped you in your professional career?
Somewhat. MBA has become a kind of a controversial degree nowadays. I think I'm glad I got it.
Okay.
But I don't know if it's the only path forward now. I think it's really beneficial if you go to one of the top, 10 schools. If you're getting your MBA from Harvard, you're going to do well.
Right.
From public schools, a lot of them have been shifting more to online. So U of I, for example, I went in person, and now they don't even offer an in-person. It's all online. So it seems like they're shifting that way, and perhaps it was a smart shift now that we have a pandemic.
From someone who also has an MBA, I get it. I think the MBA has a lot of value for some aspects if what you want to do, and also for online. I think that's really great to allow people to keep working. And in this day and age, it's a huge deal to like enroll full time into an MBA program and show up every day. I don't know how you'd be able to have a job and do that at the same time. So I think that's a big benefit probably of the online program is what they're thinking.
Yeah, it's hard to give up 2 years of salary.
Right. Yeah.
I was happy to go to Champaign, but people would, after you've worked for a few years, probably would rather live in Chicago or, a big city.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I went straight from undergrad to MBA. And did it in person because I never I never knew what a salary was. I can't imagine if I started working, then giving that back up later in life. It's probably, that's difficult. But anyways, congrats on that. I know it's either way, it's not an easy undertaking. Any graduate degree it's serious stuff. I mean, you really put everything into it. And I know how hard that is. So congrats on that. And congrats on the recent wedding. And I'm excited for what questions you have. Question four, you ready?
Yeah.
Okay.
Question four, something I've been struggling with for quite a while, and still am now, is, you know, I like to be invested, but practically I have to keep, you know, like some amount of cash available. Like with the house, you know, we want to make all these improvements to it.
Yeah.
It's not perfect. So we need to save in order to have money to be able to do what we want. And with interest rates, you know, so low, it pains me to see myself getting nothing, you know, especially if I'm saving up for a big improvement that'll take years to do. I don't know, like, what to do with cash or liquid investments.
Yeah, it's definitely been tricky, and it's been really tricky since the financial crisis about 10, 12 years ago, because cash in the bank just hasn't done much, and it's going to continue to do not much when interest rates are low. And it's a very interesting balancing act, because you need cash, right? You need cash, one, if you're trying to save for a house, that's a purpose. And two, if you have an emergency, especially in COVID, you need to make sure, a lot of times it's for health emergencies, right? You also might want to go on a trip. You know, we all want to go on a trip soon once this ends. You might have other things to save up for. So in terms of cash, I generally recommend to have about, younger people should be 3 to 6 months of their salary saved in cash as an emergency fund. So, you know, if you're making $100,000 a year, not 3 to 6 months of income, 3 to 6 months of your fixed expenses. So that's your mortgage, all that stuff you have to pay. Like if you lost your job, you'd have to pay the stuff anyways. Most people, that's $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 a month they spend. So you multiply that, let's say, by five. So you want to have around $15,000 of cash at all time. Otherwise, unless it's for a specific goal, it's just wasted money in the bank, like you said. So if you have a goal of, I want to save this amount of cash by this time for this, you know, house or something, then that's different. That's not included. But also know that you'll need $15,000 of cash is a separate thing from your goal, right? So just take that $15,000, keep it in your reserves. And then if you need to save for a house, you're going to have to start from zero, if that makes sense. I've had it before where someone saves up. And then they're like, great, I have $40,000 in my bank account. I'm going to put that toward my home. And I'm like, I don't think you should do that. First of all, you wouldn't have any liquidity. And second, you need that cash reserves. If something happens to you, you can't just, you know, sell your house and get the money. It doesn't work like that. It's not a liquid investment. So you need things that are liquid that you can get like that without worrying about the volatility of the market and the illiquidity of real estate or, you know, arts or fine wine or whatever other alternative investing you want to do. Those are just things you have to do on the end. Most people most people are one way or another. They're just habitual spenders. And if they don't put the money into a savings account, they'll never have $15,000 because they just spend on stuff. But I find some people who are the other people who are very good savers have the opposite, where all of a sudden they're like, wait, I got like 50 grand in cash. It's probably too much, right? And it's usually one or the other, which is very interesting. Very few people have that consistent 10, 15, 20, and the rest is going to work. For instance, like that's what I do, but most people don't do that. So you need to figure out your goals. I'm going to ask you, have you done that yet? Do you know what you need to have saved to do some of those goals, and what are more important to you than others?
We have, you know, some general ideas. We'd like to, you know, get some of the tile flooring in the house done. So we price that out to some extent. It's probably, you know, between us, not as accurate of an estimate. You know, it's high level. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, exactly what it'll cost. Our upstairs doesn't have, you know, overhead lighting. So in winter, you know, like now it gets kind of gloomy up
there. Oh, okay.
Just a lamp. So there's stuff like, so, you know, we're trying to price it all out and, you know, and save for it and still, you know, not have too much cash, just not getting any interest.
Yeah. I mean, once again, I would say if, and I've worked with a few people who literally started working with me because they're like, I think I have too much cash. I need you to help me with it. And we started and I was like, wow, you have too much cash. Like it was like, you know, 50, 75, 100 plus. That's too much cash unless you're living this lavish lifestyle. So for most of the times, you know, that's a good barometer for you. But to be honest, if you keep a good amount of cash on hand for a short period of time, that's okay. It really is, right? It's the issue of all of a sudden you get too comfortable and it's only in cash. And then 10 years go by and you're like, oh, I missed that opportunity. So some people are good at figuring out, okay, I accomplished what I needed. I spent the cash on the home improvements, the short-term stuff. And then now I'm ready to move on and invest it. And sometimes people just never get to that next point. So it might be good to get a little bit better specifics. You talk to your wife and get some more specifics about, okay, what are the things we absolutely want to get done in the next, you know, year or two? What are those probably going to cost? We'll give ourselves a buffer. Always give yourselves a buffer of, you know, $5,000 or something. And if there's still cash left over at that after that, then yeah, then you have too much cash and you should invest it in something, to be honest. It doesn't have to be an exact budget, but you do need to budget those things out because otherwise you're just guessing. And once again, depending on how much cash you have, you know, you got $25,000, $50,000 of extra cash, you know, 5 or 10 years of investments over time is definitely not chump change. You know, you could double your money over that time and that's not nothing. Especially even in Chicago where things are expensive, you know, that's not nothing. So those are kind of things I recommend people. And they're good problems to have, by the way. So that's a good thing. It sounds like you guys are doing well, saving money, getting everything done. And, you know, those things always go over budget too, right? So keep that in mind when you save for it, it's going to cost you more.
We had a guy come to the house today because we were getting some, this is on top of mind because this guy came to the house today and like seeing water in the basement is.
That's never good. Yeah.
It's really unpleasant. So there's some like condensation that builds up, you know, and it drips back into the house and there's, you know, a couple grand.
Yep.
You know, we weren't saving
just
for
poof, right.
Know, for condensation home mm-hmm. improvement. It wasn't a planned expense, but yeah, it happens.
And that's why you want to have that emergency cash savings because that stuff always happens. For me, it seems to be a car. Like a car hits a pothole or something happens and, you know, $1,000 or $2,000 later for a car, for a home, it's never like, oh, that's $50. Never, right? It's always hundreds or thousands, it feels like, when you have a health event, a car, or a house, right? It always feels like $1,000 thing. That's probably not going away, right? And that's why you need to have that. I tell people too, you know, if you have those events more than others, especially if you have kids, right? If you have kids, you need to add even more to that cash savings because they're going to have stuff that's going to come up. But there's always going to be stuff in life that's going to pop up every year. Everyone I do a budget with, just add $5,000 to it because there's just always random stuff that pops up. So that's kind of just, I would just understand and accept that's going to happen going forward and just keep more cash on hand. Some people are more conservative than others too. Some people just feel more comfortable with extra cash. Nothing wrong with that. Just don't go overboard. Like I said, I literally had a few people that I met with that were in the six figures of cash. That is, you know, unless you have this insane lavish lifestyle where you're spending that, most people don't need six figures of cash on hand, right? That is too much. You're missing out on the opportunities of investments in the market. But definitely don't live your life on the edge where you're always only having $1,000 in your checking account every month. That's a roller coaster ride in itself. And it's probably not worth, yeah, you might get a few extra percent or make some extra money in the market with investments, but right, if it's causing you anxiety and blood pressure, is it worth the risk? So, you know, I would say you probably are smart enough and experienced enough to figure that out for yourself, but make sure you do figure it out. you know, I wouldn't ignore it, and I would definitely do some calculations and do some Excel sheets. I'm sure you'll enjoy those. You seem like someone who would like making those little, I do myself, like making those little cash budgets on Excel.
I know, it's weirdly enjoyable.
It is. Sure. Yeah, it's a weird profession. It drives people who like doing Excel spreadsheets and budgets and income and cash flow statements. You know, I love that stuff. So that's also why I have a job, because most people don't. They just are like, Ross, you do it. I don't like that. But yeah, I think that would help you, especially now being the new year. It's a great thing to start at the beginning of the year to get that. Okay, what's our 2021? What work do we want to get done, right? What are we going to budget out for that? And do it 1 year at a time is always good for people, especially at the beginning of the year. Make it like a New Year's resolution or something is usually a good thing to do. So yeah, hopefully that helps answer question four on that end. And then I'm going to transition to the last question, number five, for you.
Okay, number five.
Okay.
What do you think about investing in like companies from foreign countries? It's something, you know, I've wanted to do for a while. It seems like it makes sense, but I don't know, you know, like which countries, you know, have the most growth over the long term, or am I already exposed to that because, you know, McDonald's is in all these countries? Like, do I already have it, or do I need to make a more concerted effort to really go for it?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I'm going to use a story to answer that, to help answer that. So someone that we were working with a few years ago worked for Caterpillar. And this was back in the day when you used to be able to, like, companies would pay you a lot in company stock. And that used to be how they would pay you. And after Enron and everything happened, they realized that's not a good idea, because if anything happens with the company, your retirement plan's blown up. So they had $500,000-$600,000 of Caterpillar stock. And it was like, well, haven't you heard about diversifying? We need to get you in other countries. We need to get you in different companies, small companies, large companies, you know, Europe, Asia, Latin America, the rest of North America, right? You can't just have all your eggs in Caterpillar. It's not diversified. And they're like, but Caterpillar is in 178 other countries, is in 178 countries. So we're very diversified. And it just makes me remind you of what you're saying, because that is not diversification. That person was being stubborn, and unfortunately, Caterpillar's still doing fine, and they didn't listen to us, and they kept it where they were. But that's not diversification. So the answer to your question is yes. However, it's tricky. And I'll tell you what I do for mine. I like to buy individual stocks in the U.S., we know the U.S. market. We have a better understanding of the regulations of the companies, of trends and stuff. But when it comes to, and I have a few global stocks, but for the most part, I don't. And the reason why is, first of all, if you want to invest in developed markets versus undeveloped, it's a whole other story. But let's just use like Europe or China or Russia or Latin America. I don't know about you, but I only know a few companies in those, and those are large publicly traded companies. Otherwise, I think I would just be guessing, to be honest, right? And that's never a good idea. So really, when you invest in internationally, which you should, it's very important to have, you know, 20% of your holdings in international investments, because if anything happens with the market, the U.S. market, you want to have a portfolio that's not 100% tied to that. You really should do it in funds or ETFs or something that's just much better to rely on the experts. I am a financial advisor and I invest people's money, but it doesn't mean I know what's going on in the ins and outs of China or India, and I could give you the financial analyst of all those countries. It's better to rely on the professionals who do this on a daily basis and know exactly what's going on in the India fund or the Asia Developing Fund or the Latin America fund. That's the best way, in my opinion, to invest in those types of places. It costs more. There's expenses to that, but you're getting expertise. I promise you, you could spend the next 20 years to become an expert on Latin America if that's worth it for you to make some money, great. Or you could just put it in the fund that they've been doing this for 20 years and they know what they're doing. The CFAs, the professionals. So that's what I recommend, especially for international investments, to go with the fund, to go with the ETFs. You could look up some of those stuffs that are high quality as well. Go with the more popular ones, knowing you're going to get a nice, you know, 100 plus diversified portfolio in that without putting in a lot of money. Especially if you're newer and especially if you're less experienced, you should do that on that end. It's just picking stocks in China and India terrifies me. I don't understand or fully understand how regulated those markets are compared to the US. And the answer is they're not. So I want to have someone who's in there, who knows what's going on, who's talking to people. And really that's where I recommend going on that end. Knowing that I might not have as big of an upside, but that's really not the point. You just want to make sure you're covered. Hopefully that made sense on that. Have you done any on yourself, or you've kind of been a little afraid to dabble there?
Yeah, I haven't done as much as I wanted to. I'll say that because I'm not as familiar with the companies.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, I just interact with more American companies.
Yep.
Feel like I'm more confident in what they do. So somewhat, but to answer, probably not enough.
Yeah. And most people, when I look at their portfolios, much more heavily lean US versus non-US. And most of them lean in, like you said, people invest in what they feel comfortable and confident in, which is exactly why you shouldn't just randomly pick stocks in a country you don't know anything about or know much about their currency or anything like that. So yeah, it's really best to leave that stuff when it comes to that higher of a level to the professionals who are doing it. I mean, that's what I do myself. I'm not picking and choosing stocks in other countries for the most part. I'm getting in funds and I'm talking to their company and their people, and they're educating me on what's going on in these different developed markets and different stuff. And if I'm doing that, I would recommend everyone who has similar or less knowledge about this to do the same. You know, once again, if you're a CFA, if you're a financial analyst and you really know that, you know, that's another story. But 99% of the people should not be going into stuff that they're not comfortable with. Really, that's a life thing, right? I mean, you should never just, you know, if you watch an episode about rehabbing a home, you probably shouldn't just go out there and think you can do it yourself. That's just not a good idea. But I would recommend you to do some research. Once again, I tell people I can't do this on the podcast. I could talk offline all about a few different funds and stuff that are good, but there's definitely some good stuff out there and there's a lot of opportunity, you know, especially in developing, you know, Brazil and China and India and stuff that have a lot of people, a lot of potential, haven't quite made it there, but have a lot of opportunities. They usually have higher returns, but also higher risk. And there's a lot of opportunities there. You just have to find the right stuff. Especially if you're afraid of the U.S. market and the economy collapsing, it might be a good idea, right, if that's someone like you to look elsewhere that's maybe not as tied to the U.S. or currency or that stuff. And we're very global. You know, it's good to have global investments, right? McDonald's, yes, is in a lot of countries, but investing in McDonald's is a U.S. stock. I don't consider that diversified, just like Caterpillar or Nike. Right. I mean, I'm looking at stuff that's based in other countries and it's primarily providing services to other countries as well. So hopefully that answered that question. Don't be afraid. Just follow the experts.
Yeah, no, it does. Go with the, the ETFs or the different funds.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, usually in a 401k, you only have like one or two options. But if you're doing it, investing outside of your 401k, you'll have a whole lot more options. And that's where I would do it, because not every international fund is great in a 401k. It's just how it is. And I know that for sure. I usually don't do a lot of my international investing in 401ks. I do it privately outside because I have more access to the investing universe. And some of them actually are very expensive funds, but they're worth paying the extra fees to get what you need, to be honest. And I don't think that's going to change. I don't think we're going to get less global, right? I don't think getting the U.S. economy, while it's going to be strong, other companies are going to become strong too. So it's kind of good to have a little smorgasbord of everything. Was that number five?
That's number five. You hit all of them.
All right. I got to cut you off. No more questions on that. Thanks. I actually thought that those were different than some of the other guests, and I'm really glad you came on, and having someone who could ask more higher-level financial questions was very helpful. You're the first finance person to come on, so I thought that would be a good change of pace from some of this. So yeah, I hope you enjoyed your time here and got some good free advice. That seems to be everyone's everyone signs up, but thanks for the free advice. You're welcome. Yeah, thanks again for being a guest on the Money Seat. Stay safe during this time. And I guess sign off.
Thanks a lot, Ross. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Hope you had fun, and see everyone again on the next episode of the Money Seat.
Securities offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA SIPC. The opinions voiced in this podcast are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professionals prior to making a decision. All performance referenced is historical and is no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested into directly. Economic forecasts set forth may not develop as predicted, and there can be no guarantee that strategies promoted will be successful.